Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Already a solemn day of remembrance, this Memorial Day is heavy with the extra burden of the COVID-19 pandemic. Loved ones can't mourn or be together the way that they might have a year ago. And throughout this pandemic, the U.S. Armed Forces, whose primary mission is to defend the American people against enemies foreign and domestic, have had to contend with an invisible enemy. Today, we ask, what is the role of the military in a pandemic, and what should it be? I'm Shamita Basu, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway. According to a 2019 Army manual, the mission of the DoD in a pandemic is to preserve U.S. combat capabilities and readiness, and to support U.S. government efforts to save lives, reduce human suffering, and slow the spread of infection. Now, we've seen the flyovers by the Air Force Thunderbirds and Navy Blue Angels to thank the frontline heroes, the deployment of naval hospital ships to California and New York to handle patient spillover from their overburdened hospitals, and the deployment of more than 40,000 National Guard members to help states battle the virus. Well, now those deployments face a hard stop on June 24th, according to the Trump administration. That leaves the Guard members with an 89-day deployment, just one day shy of the 90-day mark that would make them eligible for early retirement and post-9/11 GI Bill benefits. We will assess all of this with two people: William Arkin, an Army veteran, journalist, and author of more than a dozen books on the military, and Jeffrey Korn, professor of law at South Texas College of Law, Houston, and retired Army lieutenant colonel. Hello, William. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
And thank you also.
And Bill, I'm curious, really, in the event of a pandemic or some kind of large public health crisis, what is the military supposed to do, and what have they been doing right now?
Well, the entire paradigm of emergency response has sort of been turned on its head as a result of coronavirus. The paradigm that we've been operating with really since 9/11 is that a disaster occurs someplace and assistance comes in from the outside. The military mobilizes resources, and they come from the outside to assist in civil government and civil response. Mm-hmm. Of course, with coronavirus, there is no outside. So we've had to turn the entire paradigm of response on its head, not just civil response, but also the military response. So I would say that in coronavirus, that the paradigm for pandemic response has really been just thrown out the window. This war plan, if you will, didn't survive contact with the enemy, as they say.
Mm. And Jeffrey, can you maybe tell us the difference between how the National Guard is supposed to function in a moment like this compared to, say, other branches?
Yeah, I will say out of the gate that I don't completely agree with the paradigm being completely flipped on its head. As a matter of fact, I think in some ways the domestic emergency response paradigm involving the military has been pretty effective to date. And what I mean by that is the expectation that if there's a crisis in the state that challenges the state authority, then the National Guard, which is under the authority of the state governor, unless it's been put into federal service by the president, will be the first military entity that will be called out to assist civil authorities. I think where I agree with Bill is that that paradigm normally functions in a state or regional basis. So, for example, where I live in Houston, during Hurricane Harvey, the governor called out the National Guard, and he could rely on other states to send support from their National Guard to bolster that response. What we have here is a national emergency. This is unprecedented in recent history. So you've got this odd situation where you have state governors calling up their National Guard units, and those units are not necessarily sufficient to meet the crisis. So they then have to go through FEMA to ask FEMA to get federal military forces to help them. And the federal forces have to come through an order through the Department of Defense, which is normally coordinated by FEMA.
I mean, have we seen anything comparable to this in the past? I take your point, Jeffrey, that this is different because it's unfolding in a national way, very differently than sort of state-centered responses. Is there anything comparable in history that we can look at and maybe learn from in terms of military response?
Well, I mean, I think that the closest thing we would have to this would be the immediate aftermath of 9/11, where it was perceived as an attack on the nation, and therefore it was predominantly a homeland defense mission initially. Mm. But generally, I would say no. I think that this is really unique because the emergency is challenging so many states at the same time, and we've seen this in the news. There are incidents in history where a state gets so overwhelmed by a civil disturbance, for example, that they have to go to the federal government and ask for assistance from federal military forces. That's very rare because federal military forces are prohibited by law from participating in law enforcement unless the president invokes a law called the Insurrection Act. The last time that happened was in response to the Los Angeles riots following the Rodney King verdict in 1992. So it's very uncommon for the federal forces to be used to support the state in a law enforcement function. It's much more common for federal forces to provide kind of humanitarian assistance to help mitigate a disaster or an emergency, because in that capacity, they're not enforcing law.
Bill, in Congress, I understand that lawmakers are currently negotiating what the next coronavirus relief package might look like. And I understand that the Pentagon has requested funds. Does it look like we will be increasing our military spending during this pandemic?
You know, it's really difficult to discuss the military on Memorial Day and be critical. There's some danger involved, both in sounding unpatriotic and disrespectful of those who do serve. But we should look at the facts of what happened here in coronavirus. At no time, despite this national crisis, did the military mobilize more than 62,000 people. And 62,000 sounds like a lot, and in fact, it is a lot. But we should also remind ourselves that on 9/11, in response to those attacks in just Washington and New York, that the National Guard mobilized the same number of people. In fact, on November 28, 2001, the National Guard and Reserve mobilization peaked at 57,000, almost exactly the same as the peak during coronavirus. Mm. Now, why do I say all of this? Because it's important for us to recognize that the military is an augmenting institution. It's not the primary responder, and it shouldn't be the primary responder. That one of the reasons why the military is limited in what it can do and how much it can mobilize is that it's not configured for civil response. These are mostly 18-year-olds with guns and people who have the mission of defending the country and fighting the nation's wars. Mm-hmm. And so rather than looking to the military and saying kind of blindly that they did a great job in coronavirus and we should give them more money, I think it's really more of a lesson of how we need to build up our civil health and public health capacities, that there's only so much that the military can contribute.
So let's talk about one aspect there of healthcare capacity. And maybe, Jeffrey, you can speak to this. There was some controversy over the naval ships that docked in California and New York to handle patient overflow from hospitals. Some people pointed out that it didn't seem like those ships really handled as many COVID patients as they should have. Tell us what you know about that.
Yeah, first off, I couldn't agree more with Bill that there's a general public, I guess, misunderstanding of what the military is. When this began, I heard mayors and governors saying, get the military in here, get the military in here. Mm-hmm. I mean, an armored division or a mechanized infantry battalion is not going to do much to help you when you're trying to provide medical care. And the military doesn't have an endless supply of indigenous medical capability. What they have is the ability to deploy medical resources very quickly and get them set up very quickly, but they are very carefully tailored to the needs of the force, meaning, you know, if there's a combat support hospital, like, you know, the TV show MASH, there's a mobile combat support hospital. That hospital is designated to provide medical support to the troops in the field during a war. And when the hospital ships were sent to New York and Los Angeles, I think people have to recognize that for Pentagon planners, the world is a very unpredictable place. And we don't know what's coming down the road a week from now or 2 weeks from now. We've learned this through history. And those ships might necessarily have to be diverted very quickly to support the combat forces they're principally tasked to provide medical care to. So my reaction when I saw that the hospital ship in New York was not taking COVID patients, that it was being used for non-COVID treatment to free up resources in the civilian hospitals for COVID,
right,
was not that that was a failure. To me, that was logical, because the last thing that DOD could accept would be the idea that as suddenly an emergency arose somewhere, the ship had to deploy to provide medical support, and half of the ship's crew had been exposed to coronavirus. So it's a very difficult balance for DOD to make when they commit their resources in support of civil authority, because they have actual national security missions that they always have to be prepared to execute.
And Jeffrey, what do you think we can learn from the way that the military has been deployed in this moment and the way that the military is acting within its own ranks?
Well, I think one of the lessons that's going to come out of this, and one of the points of inquiry, is how prepared the nation is for a real national emergency, and what is the right balance at the federal response level between the use of military assets and non-military assets. I actually think there are a lot of unanswered questions about the impact of this event on readiness, the inability to engage in training, the inability to move people around, the inability to engage in coalition training and operations, I think is going to have a negative effect on readiness. But I also think there's another interesting aspect of this, and that is that there are times when a response like this requires the ability of leadership to order certain measures that have to be complied with.
Jeffrey Korn is professor of law at South Texas College of Law Houston and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. And William Arkin is an Army veteran, a journalist, and author of more than a dozen books on the military. Thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Samita.
Thank you.
Who are you remembering on this Memorial Day?
Susan from Washington State. I am remembering a Vietnam veteran, a man I was engaged to as an 18-year-old girl. I broke up with him when he deployed to what I thought would be an easy tour for him in Turkey, but I just recently learned he did go to Vietnam, and I'm so sorry to know how he suffered and how it impacted the rest of his life. So he is on my mind this Memorial Day.
Hey, I'm calling from Morristown, New Jersey, and my name is Mercedes. My grandfather fought in World War II in Germany. I'm really proud of his contribution as a Puerto Rican man of color, especially in light of today's political narrative. Thank you.
My name is Kenneth, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I will be remembering my dad, who lived from 1925 to 2015. He served in the North Atlantic, the Mediterranean, the South Pacific, and China. I gave him a thank you card every November for the last 20 years of his life.
Hi, this is BJ Anderson from Scio, Oregon. My grandfather was a veteran of World War I, and my dad was a veteran of World War II. My wife and I will be tending our memorial garden that we planted to honor all of our loved ones. In normal years, we'd have a couple hundred people gathering at our farm. This year, it will be just the two of us, reflecting on how the global challenge that we're all fighting today is not a war, and on how we don't have a president inspiring and unifying the country, with America proudly joining forces against a global threat as it did in those two world wars.
Heard some of your stories of veterans that you're remembering on this Memorial Day. And now we want to turn to a bigger conversation about honoring those we've lost in this moment. Along with our colleagues at Death, Sex, and Money and the newsroom of our home station, WNYC, we've been asking for your memories and stories about the people you've lost during the COVID-19 crisis.
This is Elizabeth, calling from Boston, and my brother Charles was 42. The oldest of three children and a loyal big brother to his two little sisters. And what I will never forget is his bright blue eyes, his inescapable humor, his dizzying vocabulary, his biting wit, and most certainly his love for his son.
Hi, this is Kelly from Tampa, and we lost my grandmother on Mother's Day weekend, and even 13 years deep into the dementia that stole so much of her, all Nana Joni needed was a glass of white Zinfandel, our Spotify playlists, and our company for her to laugh at every joke and to endlessly repeat, "The sky is so blue, the trees are full of fruit, and we could not ask for a better day." I will surely remember that and so much more about her, and we were lucky to have her.
Rika, Grant's pass. I'll never forget that she was my mother, and she spent 40 years, worked hard for 40 years to write family letters to keep her children connected.
My name's Amy. What's unforgettable about my mother's sense of adventure? She was a trailblazer in so many ways that I only appreciated much later. She thought nothing of loading the three of us, plus one friend each, into the car and setting off for a museum in Boston or Salisbury Beach in winter, plus our dogs, or to stand with the crowds to catch a glimpse of a visiting dignitary. She believed in the power of witnessing events firsthand and making up one's own mind, a quality that stood her in good stead during her long career as a photojournalist covering life in small-town southern New England for the Eagle Tribune.
I'm commending Reverend Philip Kaczerski for what a wonderful husband he was. He and his wife, Erin, did so many things together, and they would share their pictures and their stories. And those of us who knew him and loved him knew how much he treasured his relationship with Erin. My name is Kathleen Saline, and I'm calling from Girard, Ohio.
Hi, this is Katie from St. Louis, Missouri. And I am honoring Grandpa Ted, who died on Mother's Day. And I will never forget his smile and his ability to communicate, even though he lost his speech 6 years ago after a stroke.
This is Elizabeth Abraham from Minneapolis. My husband passed away August 2nd of 2019. And what I remember most is his wonderful love for me. And it was mutual.
Joining me to talk about some of what you've shared and the act of remembering in this moment is Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money. Anna, hi, and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thanks for being here. What a time for your show, Death, Sex, and Money, three things that we need to talk about more and things that have gotten even bigger and more complicated during a pandemic, I would imagine.
Yeah, all things that we're dealing with that are always hard, but we're dealing with more in isolation than usual. And in particular, I think death is one of those things that's really hard to figure out how to move through and grieve when you're doing it in isolation.
Sure. So why did you and your team want to collect these stories, these memories right now?
Well, I mean, clearly there's just so much death and loss around us, you know, almost 100,000 deaths here in the U.S. from COVID-19. And even if the deaths happening now that aren't related to the coronavirus, we're not able to sort of mark them through familiar rituals in the ways that we would when we aren't in isolation or sheltering at home. And when you don't have the rituals that we normally do to mark loss, I think that there's not a space to think about the meaning of people in your lives. There's not a space to gather together and to grieve together. So we wanted to try to create this other new space of an email inbox to send your memories of people you've lost, just to mark them, to mark their loss and to say this is what it meant that they were here.
Mm. Let's play one of those memories that a listener sent in. This is Rebecca in Colorado.
I unfortunately lost my grandmother to COVID-19, and I live across the country from my whole family. So it's been just like this really isolating experience. But I'm trying to remember a lot of the positives. My grandmother was always just this ray of sunshine. She loved being with family. It was so important to her. And she used to call me her rainbow, which I always took with like a grain of salt. But looking back, it was such a beautiful word to describe the relationship that she and I had together. And even though she's gone, that love of family is something that I think continues on through all of us.
Oh, that's such a lovely detail that her grandmother called her a rainbow. I feel like we've been hearing from lots of people just how difficult it is to not have that physical gathering and to be apart at this time. Have you been hearing that a lot from folks, the difficulty of grieving alone and not together?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for people who are losing people close to them, you know, even if they're nearby, just not being able to be physically next to them while they pass is really upsetting. And then if you're grieving far away, even if you weren't that close to someone who died, when you don't have a place to go for a memorial service, for example, where you can just like go through a receiving line and say to the family members of someone who died, you know, I will miss them, and give a hug. When all you have is words, it's different. And so we're not really skilled at that. We're not really skilled at saying to somebody, calling them up and saying, this is what your mother meant to me, and I want you to know that. So we're all having to sort of sort through these very different kind of social interactions while we can't be alongside one another physically. It's hard.
Now, Anna, I want to share a call that came to us this week. It came from someone whose father died very recently.
My name is James Botello from Providence, Rhode Island. My father was one of the most amazing men I've ever known. He was an amazing husband, an amazing father, naval war veteran in Vietnam. He just passed recently due to lung cancer from chemicals and various agents in Vietnam. The man could build anything and fix anything with his amazing hands. He created the world with his amazing hands, and I, his only son, have his hands. I see them every day, and I try to use them as well for my family as he did for his.
I just want to thank James for sharing his father's memory with all of us. I mean, that's quite a metaphor. I see my father's hands and think about what he built, and I want to build something similar.
You have been hearing from people who are not just describing a very close family member, right? You've been hearing from some folks who are describing acquaintances or maybe even people that they knew in passing, but that had a really big impact on them, right?
Yeah, these are some of my favorite messages because it's just the kind of thing that maybe over the potluck at the after the memorial service, the kinds of stories that would get passed between acquaintances of people. I like hearing these, and they don't really have anywhere else to go right now. This is a message we got from a woman named Dina in Bloomfield, New Jersey. She sent in this memory.
Andy Giuliano put up with me for decades as my go-to contractor. He taught me that anything built could be taken apart to stack moving boxes close to the front door, and that an estimate is only an estimate. He attracted the best, most meticulous team and made my dreams come true, project after project, decade after decade. He even built a home for my tortoise. I'm going to miss Andy forever, and the world is less without him.
He built a home for her tortoise. That
yeah.
is meaningful. When we lose someone, and even if it's someone that we didn't know all that well or wasn't related to us, I think that we start to assemble these lists, right? The things that we will always associate them with. And that's what I heard in Dina's message.
Yeah.
Anna, you've been talking on your show, Death, Sex, and Money. It's been around for 6 years now. You've been talking with people about death and processing death for all these years. And I wonder what you feel like you've learned from people about the value of talking about grief and loss and what we can be thinking about in this moment when there is so much grief and loss happening.
You know, something I've been thinking about a lot is I've heard from people who have experienced really deep grief, how much they appreciate when people in their lives, acquaintances, like people will bring up somebody who's died. They can notice that people will avoid talking about somebody who's died because they don't want to upset you or they kind of don't know what to say. And just what a gift it can feel like when somebody says, oh, I was thinking about your husband the other day. Do you remember when this happened? And just getting to share memories with one another. That's something that I hope this project kind of prompts people to do, to say this stuff out loud to the people in your lives, to create community around loss and to honor people's memories. It's something that you can do, and you have to try a little harder right now because we're not all going to gather in one room and think about someone's life and their meaning and their legacy because we can't do that right now. So you have to pick up the phone or write that note or record that voice memo. It's up to us to take that step.
It takes a little extra effort, you're saying, in this moment. Yeah. We will keep collecting your memories and stories of people that you've lost during this time. Record your memory on your phone. Email it to remembering@wnyc.org. And we'll stay in touch with Anna and all of our friends at Death, Sex, and Money to let you know when they'll be sharing more about this project. Anna Sale, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carnegie Hall has welcomed a dizzying array of performers.
To have Andy Kaufman, Frank Zappa, and Birgit Nielsen and Horowitz on the same stage, it becomes this kaleidoscope of our history.
I'm Jessica Vosk. Join me for the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk. It's all about our unique cultural history, as witnessed by one of New York's most beloved institutions, Carnegie Hall. Listen now, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Shamita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. It's good to have you with us on Memorial Day. We have one more conversation for you. Since the pandemic began, the volume of obituaries and paid death notices in our newspapers have become a powerful reminder of the loss we're all experiencing right now. And in the absence of traditional mourning rituals like funerals, the obituary pages are becoming a communal space for us to grieve together in this moment. For more on what obituaries mean during this pandemic, I spoke with Maureen O'Donnell, the obituary writer for the Chicago Sun-Times and a former president of the Society of Professional Obituary Writers, and John Pope, a contributing writer for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, and the author of the book Getting Off at Elysian Fields, Obituaries from the New Orleans Times-Picayune. John's been writing obituaries for decades now, and he's developed a pretty good sense for what makes a good obituary. Here's what he's always looking for.
Something that punches my quirky buttons. Something that makes me think, wow, this is something people would like to know about. For instance, there was a dear friend of mine who was the city's chief administrative officer. Her father had died. He was a letter carrier. Everyone loved him. And we chatted about that for a while. I said, okay, Brenda, what else you got? She said, well, Pope, in World War II, he was a spy. And I said, cool. He was one of the few African Americans in counterintelligence. He was assigned to pubs along the English Channel, probably where black GIs went to see if word of D-Day might be leaking out. And he was one of the first guards in a presidential security detail. Now, that's a cool story.
John's talked about finding the rosebud moment. You know, the reference to Citizen Kane. You're finding out what makes somebody tick. And one of my favorite obituaries was about kind of a typical Chicago area resident named Jim Cole. He grew up in a well-to-do suburb, but became fascinated by bears at a young age. And he wound up moving to the American West, and he became a wildlife photographer specializing in grizzly bears. In the course of my research, which was spurred just by a classified death notice mentioning his love of grizzly bears. In the course of my research, I wound up talking to a gentleman, I think his title was Director of Bear Management at one of our national parks. And it turned out Jim Cole was the only known person in North America to have survived not one, but two attacks by grizzly bears, because in his photography, he got a little too close to some mama bears.
What are the components of an obituary? What are the parts that you're definitely looking for?
You're always finding out, you know, who they are, occupation, survivors, where they died, when they died, and where they were born. I like to ask questions that elicit more than a yes or no answer. You don't want to say, you know, did your mother enjoy cooking or did your mother enjoy dancing? I want to know, what kind of a car did she drive? Did she like dogs? Oh, what kind of dog? Oh, she had 8 boxers in her lifetime. And what TV shows did she like? How about if I walked into her house? What's the first thing I'd notice? So I'm asking specific questions to make that person come alive again.
I like to take my cue from a question on the first night of Passover. It's a variant on the question, how is this night different from all other nights? My question is, how is this person or how is this story different from all other stories?
And you know, there's a saying, this specific is universal. Great Indian film director Meera Nair, I think, said that, and Roger Ebert, our film critic, used to quote her. The more specific you find out about the person, the more universal that story is. You know, whether you're writing about a Japanese American who settled in Chicago after getting out of an internment camp, or an Irish immigrant, or an African American who came north in the Great Migration, or someone who fled the Middle East after conflict. Yes, those are specific stories, but they're universal too. It's every grandparent's or great-grandparent's story.
So since you're both professional obituary writers and thinkers, I hear what you're saying, that you're often looking for kind of a quirky or interesting detail when you're deciding who to write about. But what about during a crisis like the one we're currently going through? How do you decide who gets an obituary in this moment and who doesn't?
We pitch stories, but it's up to the editor to say yay or nay. And it's not as simple as saying, oh, someone died, let's do an obit. No, no. This crisis is happening at a point when the print industry is already an economic crisis. And with the COVID-19 epidemic, the number of ads has shrunk, which means the number of pages and news hole have shrunk. But it has to be someone who has not only succumbed to coronavirus, but also someone who was somehow noteworthy. For instance, one of the people I wrote about here was an OBGYN who delivered more than 3,000 babies during his career. Another one opened up the U.S. trade with China after 30 years. And most recently, there was a community college administrator who died of the virus, and she was a saint. She helped kids buy textbooks. She gave them transit passes when they didn't have money. That obit has gotten more feedback on Facebook and on our newspaper's website than any other obit I've ever written. Thousands of people. And it reminded me of what, again, other cinematic reference, what Clarence the Angel said to George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life. One person's life touches many others.
Maureen, what about for you? Who are some of the people that you've been writing obituaries for during this time?
One thing that I like to do, and I think it's a service to our readers, is to write about a variety of people, different ethnicities, different professions, different generations, different genders, people who've seen life's rich pageant, whether it was surviving the Spanish flu epidemic or liberating a concentration camp in World War II or inventing a chocolate chip cookie recipe. I've often said that I think obituary writers are frustrated history teachers. You know, we're trying to share different stories with our readers. And some of the coronavirus obituaries I've done, one, of course, you couldn't ignore. It was John Prine, you know, one of the most beloved troubadours in America. He was admired by everyone from Bob Dylan to the Black Keys to Casey Musgraves to Roger Waters from Pink Floyd, and started out as a postman in Maywood, Illinois, right outside of Chicago. John Prine used to start composing his lyrics in his head while he was walking, delivering mail. I also wrote about a woman, Amelia Pontarelli. She helped operate Tony's Italian Deli in Chicago, and she fed thousands of people with her ready-made meals and lasagna. This was a woman who survived the Nazis coming to her mountaintop town in Italy at 12 or 14 years old. Her father had to drag her away from the Nazis because she was raining verbal abuse on them when they stole her pet goat for lunch. She immigrated, started a new life in America, worked at the family business, and COVID took her.
Now, you've both mentioned such specific and human and lovely details about some of the people that you've written about. Can you tell us how you find out these really specific details when you want to write an obituary? And I imagine, I wonder whether that process is different in the obituaries you're writing right now for people who are dying at this moment, especially non-celebrities?
We're reporters, and we just have to find out something that will give us more than what I call a resume obit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my friend Molly Ivan said that's about as dull as bus station chili. I'm doing an obit today on the founder of the New Orleans Film Festival. A friend said, whenever I walked into a movie, if he was standing in the lobby, he'd talk about the movie, and that would be better than the film I was seeing. Just little details that make the person stand out. It's all about the details.
Yes, and that's a hardy perennial. You do that whether it's the year 2000 or the year 2020. When I'm writing about somebody like John Prine, who's so well known, I'm looking for the Chicago stories from his origins that people may not know.
And you always look for the greater context. Mm. Here we have food. Two of my favorite obits are food obits. Ella Brennan, who is the matriarch of the family that runs Commander's Palace and other restaurants, and Leah Chase, the queen of Creole cuisine who fed the civil rights movement. So you put Miss Leah, who died last year at the age of 96, against this background of the civil rights movement. She fed the civil rights movement. James Baldwin loved her gumbo, and it turns into a pretty rich story.
You know, on this show a few weeks ago, we talked about funerals right now and how, of course, the pandemic has really complicated our ability to mourn collectively. Have you been thinking about the function of the obituary pages in this moment and how they're possibly filling that gap?
It definitely is, because there's no other way to do it publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Ellis Marsalis, who was a major New Orleans musician who lived in my neighborhood, deserved a second line. Brass band with people following with umbrellas and hankies, celebrating his life.
That's a true New Orleans funeral, right?
Yeah, I notice when I see page after page after page of death notices, there are, it's grieving. If I may make one point here that I was thinking of when Maureen was telling her wonderful stories, what we're doing here is what Marguerite Fox, in a documentary called Obit, said that an obituary is only tangentially about death. What you're doing in an obituary is recalling and perhaps celebrating the person's life.
These are sort of the way we're communally grieving now. Yes, funeral homes are live streaming wakes and live streaming graveside services, but I think the death notices that I'm seeing in the Chicago Sun-Times are expanding. I think that the family, friends, and funeral homes are putting in so many more details as a way to sort of be a community support group. I mentioned to someone this week that I was reading a death notice about a woman who loved cats. And yes, you know, in the past I might see she loved her cat Binky. But in this death notice, they mentioned every cat the individual had ever owned. And it was so endearing to me to read about Binky, Storm, Ginger, Aoife, Midnight, Princess. That was probably every cat this person owned from when they were 16 to when they were 86. And before the coronavirus pandemic, I'm not so sure people would have put in every cat, you know, but I think it's something we need to do to connect and celebrate each other.
Well, it makes me think of what Linda Lohman said near the end of Death of a Salesman: attention must be paid.
Yes.
And then also, Marshall McLuhan, when I was in college back ages ago, said that seeing a story about an event you attended means that event mattered. Same with an obit or a death notice. It means that this person mattered in the overall scheme of things.
You've been writing obits for decades now. I wonder how what you're doing right now compares to the process you went through writing obituaries during other crises. Like during Hurricane Katrina, for example, I know you're in New Orleans, or the AIDS crisis.
Well, first of all, a story is a story. And we report the story, whatever the occasion might be. AIDS is more appropriate because I started writing obituaries in the early days of AIDS, back when nobody really knew what caused it and everybody was terrified. I don't think we should attach a whole lot of what I call woo-woo to COVID obits. I mean, they are news stories. Yes, the occasion is sad, but we report the same way we report any other obituary at any other time. go after the facts, see where they lead you.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you've actually written your own obituary, right?
Twice.
What were both of those processes like?
Why did you write it twice?
First of all,
you're an editor, John.
Well, there was so much more to put in. No, in 2001, I was a medical reporter when I had a Centers for Disease Control fellowship. I thought, no telling where I'll wind up, so I'll have an obit ready. Ah. Well, I survived. And in 2015, I was going on a safari to Kenya and Tanzania. I thought, better update that obit, Pope.
Wow. I mean, how did it feel to sort of steel yourself for writing something that would be read by others about you after your death?
Who better to write it? Also, I mean, I wrote my wife's obituary the day she died because I knew her better than anyone else. I didn't want any lesser hands to touch it.
As obituary writers, you are very used to confronting death and dying. What have you learned from thinking about death and loss that could be helpful for listeners to hear right now?
Don't put off till tomorrow what you should be doing today. I've written, and John will probably agree with me, I've written so many obituaries where somebody retired on a Friday and they died suddenly the following Tuesday. And the relative said to me, he always wanted to go on a safari. He always wanted to see the Great Barrier Reef. He always dreamed of seeing Venice. And that has definitely impacted my life.
I turned 70 a year and a half ago. My motto became, if not now, when? And just do it. I want to go to Rwanda to see the gorillas. I want to go to India. I went to Antarctica in January. Again, I wanted to go. And Maureen is absolutely right. And you also learn kindness and patience. Never argue with the family of the deceased. Never. Yes, you write the story, but they can decide whether they want to talk to you because you don't have a subpoena. Eventually, they'll come around to your point of view. My mother quoted scripture a lot. A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. So you don't want to alienate the people you need to talk to.
I have one other thought about lessons I've learned from writing obituaries. I'm a child of Irish immigrants, and I frequently have gone to the Irish American Heritage Center here in Chicago for dances, for Irish fests, for St. Patrick's Day. And for more than 20 years, you know, I would watch the Cayley dancers doing traditional Irish dances with fabulous names like the Siege of Venice, dances named after old wars and battles. And in the middle of all these Irish Americans and Irish immigrants doing the dances was an African American man. And he was very serious and he was very good at these dances. And I always meant to introduce myself to him to find out his story. Well, I didn't. You know, the years go by, you're busy. I'll see him at the next festival. Well, he died a couple of years ago, and I decided to look into his life, and it was fascinating. His name was Alan Beale. I think he was a physicist. He had a scientific background, and he was fascinated by the patterns of these dances, which are kind of like square dancing, you know, precursors to square dancing. And he not only became adept at these dances, he knew more of these dances than I will ever know. And he knew their origins from the 1500s, 1600s, and he became this beloved Cayley dancer who would go all over the Midwest with other dancers to perform and enjoy these old airs, as the Irish call it. And I wrote a little story, and most of the time we try to keep ourselves out of obituaries, John, right? But this time I put myself in there, and I said, please don't wait till tomorrow to introduce yourself to a person, to reconnect with an old high school friend, to right a wrong, to say you're sorry. You know, do it now, because Alan passed away very young.
I saw my high school physics teacher in a checkout line years ago with his mother. I should have gone up and said, Mr. Meyer, I'm John Pope. I just want to tell you how much you meant to me and how much you've shaped my thinking. I didn't.
John Pope is a contributing writer for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, and Maureen O'Donnell is the obituary writer for the Chicago Sun-Times. So fascinating, so great to talk to both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
thank you so much for being with us on this Memorial Day. You can call us anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway with any of your thoughts. You can also tweet at me if you'd like. I'm at ShuBasu. That's S-H-U-B-A-S-U. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Shamita Basu in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.